Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are opening up a file that, well, on the surface, it might seem like a pretty niche footnote in religious history.
It really might.
But for anyone who is seriously trying to understand the foundations and, frankly, the credibility of a major global faith, this file, the one on the Kinderhook plates, it isn't a footnote at all. It's maybe the definitive, scientifically testable benchmark.
It really is the moment where faith collides with objective physical reality. We've done deep dives before on Joseph Smith being sustained as a prophet, seer, revelator, and translator.
Right.
And, you know, prophet and revelator, those roles are rooted in spiritual perception,
yeah.
are hard to quantify, hard to test. But translator, that's different. That's a technical skill. It implies accuracy.
Exactly. We know the history is complex. I mean, we've talked about the Book of Mormon, which ultimately relies on a spiritual witness because we don't have the source material to check.
And we've looked at the Book of Abraham, where we do have some of the source documents, and modern Egyptology shows, well, a clear and undeniable translation failure.
So what makes the Kinderhook plates so different?
They offer something unique. This was a fabricated text specifically designed as a trap. The prophet was tested on the spot. And this is the crucial part one. Of the place from this hoax was later recovered, scientifically analyzed, and proven definitively to be a 19th century fabrication.
So this gives us the final, cleanest, and most decisive data point for evaluating Joseph Smith in that specific role as a translator.
It does.
Our mission for this deep dive, then, is to trace the full and frankly bizarre timeline of this whole event. We're starting with the stage discovery back in 1843 in Illinois.
And we're going to follow that paper trail through nearly a century and a half of sustained institutional defense by church leaders. We're talking about everyone from the hugely influential historian B.H. Roberts all the way up to Apostle Mark E. Peterson in 1979.
And then the reckoning. The moment science forces the church into a shocking, sudden, and complete narrative reversal in 1981.
Yet this is really less about the fraudulent plates themselves and more about what the historical defense and the cover-up that followed reveals about the concept of prophetic discernment.
And the internal logical traps this whole episode creates for his other translation claims, right? Especially the Book of Abraham.
Especially the Book of Abraham.
So our sources today, they're grounded in the actual records. We're looking at historical journals, internal church minutes, and official publications like the Times and Seasons, and later, the Ensign. For you at home, if you're keeping a credibility scorecard for Joseph Smith, this is easily one of the top five topics you absolutely have to master.
It's powerful corroborating evidence. It doesn't just confirm the problems we see with the Book of Abraham. It also highlights the persistence of that folk magic and treasure-digging background that really set the stage for all of his translation claims.
All right, let's unpack the discovery itself, because from the very first moment they put a shovel in the ground, the whole operation just feels steeped in that familiar lore of Joseph Smith's early days.
Oh, it's a perfect setup. The discovery happens in Kinderhook, Illinois, on April 16th, 1843. It's led by a local guy named Robert Wiley.
And he's, what, just some guy who got lucky?
Not at all. He's an antique enthusiast, and crucially, he's a man who is very well versed in the kind of visionary folklore that surrounded treasure hunting in that era. He knew the playbook.
And the mechanism of discovery he uses is straight out of that playbook, isn't it? He claimed he had the exact same dream three nights in a row.
Three nights in a row. The power of three is a critical traditional element in folk magic. A single dream. You could dismiss that as, you know, just a dream.
A coincidence.
But a triple repetitive visionary experience, that validates the whole operation. It convinces everyone involved that they're acting on divine or at least supernatural instructions. The dream becomes the spiritual authorization you need to go dig for buried treasure.
And this should be ringing some serious bells for anyone who has followed Joseph Smith's own story. We've talked about the trials in Bainbridge, New York, the treasure-seeking days with his seer stone.
Absolutely. Think about the Josiah Stoll anecdote.
The Spanish silver mine.
Yes, the failed excavation where he was using his seer stone. And when the treasure sank deeper into the earth because of a spiritual guardian, the story was quickly revised. Suddenly they claimed they found a single anachronistic feather with the treasure.
The feather was the proof. The minimal evidence needed to say, see, the vision was real even if we didn't get the gold.
The Kinderhook discovery uses the exact same psychological mechanism. A visionary dream validates the location, and then, lo and behold, artifacts appear in the exact spot the vision pointed to.
And the people involved in this digging party, they weren't just random bystanders, were they?
They were carefully selected. On that final day of digging, they deliberately included a member of the LDS Church in the group.
Why? What was the purpose of that?
That was the final, critical step to make sure the hoax worked. Including a church member guaranteed the artifacts wouldn't just go to some skeptical academic society in Boston or Philadelphia.
It ensured they'd go straight to the prophet.
Word spread like wildfire through the Nauvoo community. The artifacts were rushed directly to Joseph Smith, the known translator of ancient records. The expectation was immediate. The prophet will figure this out, just like he did with the Book of Mormon plates.
So tell us about the artifacts themselves. What did they supposedly find 10 feet down in a mound?
They found 6 bell-shaped plates. They're described as being made of brass, and they were covered on both sides, so 12 sides total, with these strange unknown symbols.
And they were just sitting there.
They were buried about 10 feet deep, alongside skeletal remains that were described as belonging to a very large man, you know, suggesting an ancient king or maybe a giant from a lost race.
So the scene is perfectly set to look like the discovery of ancient sacred records. It's almost a mirror image of how he described finding the gold plates.
It's the same pattern. And within 2 weeks, those plates are in Joseph Smith's hands. And just days after he gets them, his personal scribe, William Clayton, records the prophet's official finding.
This is the key moment, isn't it? The direct link.
This is the smoking gun. Clayton's journal entry from May 1st, 1843, links Joseph directly to the translation claim. He writes unequivocally, President Joseph has translated a portion of the plates.
And this isn't just some guy on the street. This is his most trusted scribe writing in what is essentially an official record.
Exactly. This wasn't speculation. This was the report from inside the prophet's own home.
And what was that declaration? What did the partial translation say?
According to Clayton, the plates contain the history of the person with whom they were found. And this person was, quote, a descendant of Ham through the lines of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who received his kingdom from the ruler of heaven and earth.
Let's just pause right there, because that partial translation, just that one little bit, instantly creates massive internal consistency problems, especially when you put it next to the Book of Abraham.
It's a powerful and revealing echo. First, just look at the terminology. Joseph Smith makes the exact same fundamental error with the word Pharaoh.
He treats it like a name.
He treats it like a proper name, not a title. Pharaoh, king of Egypt. The title Pharaoh actually means great house, but he's using it as a foundational lineage name, which is the precise historical error he made in the Book of Abraham when he was establishing the cursed lineage.
It's not just a linguistic mistake, though. It's theological, too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The second and far more concerning connection is the persistence of this Ham and Curse of Cain narrative. The idea that the lineage of Ham was cursed, often associated with dark skin, and specifically excluded from holding the priesthood.
A theology that was formalized in the Book of Abraham and the Book of Moses.
Exactly. And here, in this brand new, partially translated record, Joseph Smith immediately goes back to that well. He incorporates that codified scriptural racism again, claiming the man found in the mound was a descendant of Ham.
It suggests that this doctrine was just central to how he interpreted any text he came across.
It shows a consistent pattern. It doesn't matter what the source material is, gold plates, changes to the Bible, Egyptian papyri. He finds and codifies the same controversial theological themes over and over again.
And the problem gets even worse just a few days later, right? Apostle Parley P. Pratt weighs in.
He does. On May 7, 1843, he publicly comments on the plates. He compares the characters on them to the characters from the Book of Abraham papyrus, and explicitly links the skeleton found in the burial to the ancient Jaredites.
The Jaredites from the Book of Mormon, the people who were in the Americas before the Nephites.
Yes, saying that they descended from Ham.
So now the church is in a real bind with its own canon. If you have a powerful descendant of Ham who's linked to this cursed lineage, founding a kingdom in the Americas, how does that fit with the Book of Mormon narrative?
It forces an impossible triangulation.
Yeah.
Joseph now has to justify the Book of Mormon, the Book of Abraham, and the Kinderhood plates, all of which are hinting at different, sometimes competing, stories about who came to the Americas and when.
And the church didn't treat this as some interesting but unverified curiosity. They gave it the full ring of church sanction.
The endorsement was swift, and it was public. The Times and Seasons, which was the main church newspaper, printed a letter where the author says with absolute confidence that the plates would go to prove the authenticity of the Book of Mormon, which it undoubtedly will.
That is institutional endorsement at the highest level.
And it went even deeper. John Taylor, who was editing the Nauvoo Neighbor at the time, and who would later become the third prophet of the church, he published facsimiles of all 12 sides of the plates.
He didn't just mention them, he printed pictures of them for everyone to see.
And he backed it up with a public promise. He stated unequivocally that a full translation would be published in the Times and Seasons as soon as the translation is completed.
That is a phenomenal level of institutional confidence, isn't it? John Taylor is essentially putting the church's entire reputation on the line, broadcasting to the world that Joseph Smith is about to deliver a full new sacred text.
You really can't overstate the magnitude of that public endorsement. This was not skepticism. This was an active, publicized declaration that these things were real, ancient, and being deciphered by God's power. They were leveraging it as immediate, tangible proof for the Book of Mormon.
So for the next few decades, the Kinderhook plates just sort of settled into church lore. Joseph Smith is killed in 1844, and the plates become part of this narrative about his prophetic genius, even though a full translation never appeared. But history rarely stays buried, does it?
Not forever. The stability of that story was first shattered 36 years later. In 1879.
What happened then?
This is when Wilbur Fugate, one of the original members of the digging party and one of the main hoaxers, finally breaks his silence. He writes a very detailed letter to a man named James Cobb, explaining everything.
He confesses. He admits the plates were fabricated from the start, specifically to trap Joseph Smith.
It wasn't a random prank. It was a targeted theological test.
Yeah.
They wanted to expose what they believed was a fraudulent claim to be a translator.
And he didn't just say, hey, we faked it. He gets details.
Oh, yeah. He described the whole fabrication process, how they used old pieces of brass, cut them into that bell shape, and then used a mixture of acids, probably nitric acid, which was available, to etch the symbols onto the surface. This level of detail should have forced a major historical reevaluation.
But instead of the church investigating, the exact opposite happens. They double down and basically turn the hoaxer's confession into a secondary hoax.
Enter B. H. Roberts. And you have to understand, Roberts was not just some historian. He was a general authority, a member of the First Council of the 70. He was arguably the most important and influential apologist and institutional historian of the entire early 20th century. His word carried immense weight.
So in his 1904 book, New Witnesses for God, he takes on Fugate's claim directly. And his argument is just a fascinating piece of motivated reasoning.
Roberts argues that Fugate's letter itself is the real fraud.
Mm.
And his logic, you know, based on timing. He asks, if the plates were a fraud designed to trick Joseph, why did Fugate wait 36 years to say so?
Okay, a plausible question on the surface.
And then comes the kicker. He says, look, the church immediately accepted the plates as genuine, which Roberts freely admits they did. He even cites John Taylor's public endorsement. So he asks, why didn't the hoaxers expose Joseph Smith immediately in 1843? Why not humiliate him then and derail the whole church?
So he's effectively using the church's sustained belief in the fraud as evidence that the plates must be authentic.
Precisely. Because surely, if they were fake, the hoaxers would have capitalized on the moment right away. He completely flips the burden of proof. Robert suggests the long silence of the hoaxers is proof of their dishonesty, not evidence of Joseph Smith's failure to discern the fraud.
And that rhetorical move worked. It solidified this idea for decades that the Kinderhook plates were genuine artifacts that were just being unfairly questioned by critics.
And the institution consistently reinforced that certainty. The Improvement Era, which was a very widely read church magazine, repeatedly affirmed the partial translation.
They actively used it to bolster the Book of Mormon's claims, didn't they?
They did. You see articles using the plates as evidence to explain the supposed presence of, you know, Egyptian-style civilization and architecture in the Americas, things like truncated pyramids. The logic was, if Joseph translated this text and it confirms Egyptians descended from Ham came here, well, that explains why we find Egyptian-like artifacts. It bolsters the Book of Mormon's credibility.
And we also see a very subtle but very significant historical alteration happening around this time. In 1930, when B.H. Roberts is compiling the massive history of the church.
Yes. He makes an editorial choice. He converts William Clayton's original third-person journal entry, President Joseph has translated, into Joseph Smith's first-person voice. I have translated.
Why is that shift so important?
It subtly elevates the claim. It's no longer a scribe recording what happened. It's now an immutable first-person declaration from the prophet himself. It made it much, much harder for the church to later try and distance Joseph from the translation claim.
Then in 1962, the institutional confidence gets a massive shot in the arm. Tangible evidence surfaces again.
One of the original six plates is located. It's found and acquired by the Chicago Historical Society.
And the church sees this as the ultimate vindication.
Oh, it was a moment of triumph. W. Ricks, who is the president of the BYU Archaeological Society, writes this article in The Improvement Era saying, "The finding reaffirms his prophetic calling and definitively reveals the false statements made by one of the finders," meaning Fugate.
It's the ultimate victory lap. They thought the recovery of the physical artifact proved Fugate was a liar.
The conclusion of that article could not have been more certain. It declared, "Joseph Smith Jr. stands as a true prophet and translator of ancient records by divine means." They had physical proof, they believed, that confirmed the prophet's story.
But the defense continued right up to the very brink of the scientific reckoning. In 1979, just 1 year before the science came out, Apostle Mark E. Peterson published his book, Those Gold Plates.
And Peterson was a powerful, authoritative voice in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. His books were foundational reading. And in that book, he wrote that the Kinderhook plates are of ancient vintage and, maybe most famously, claimed that most experts agree on their authenticity.
That appeal to unnamed experts is always a bit of a red flag, but the real weight here is his position, isn't it?
Absolutely. This is an apostle, a man supposedly endowed with spiritual knowledge and discernment making, an authoritative declaration that these plates were real and ancient. This wasn't some historian speculating. This was a prophet, seer, and revelator, just 1 year before definitive, objective proof showed that his pronouncement was completely false.
So you have this sustained, century-long institutional commitment to an artifact that was, at its heart, just a cheap 19th-century prank.
And that unwavering commitment from John Taylor in 1843 to Mark E. Peterson in 1979 is what makes the reversal that comes next all the more devastating.
The historical defense, built on, well, confirmation bias and rhetorical games, slams to a complete halt in 1980 because objective science finally enters the picture.
That's right. The single existing plate held by the Chicago Historical Society was finally subjected to modern metallurgical and forensic testing.
And the goal was simple. Get past all the historical claims and just figure out what this thing actually is. Is it ancient or is it a 19th century fabrication?
And the scientific conclusion was it was completely unambiguous. The testing confirmed every single detail of Wilbur Fugate's story from 1879.
So it was unequivocally a 19th century creation manufactured specifically to trick Joseph Smith.
Yes. The idea that this was an ancient record was permanently and scientifically discarded.
Let's get into the specifics of that forensic evidence, because this is the factual wall the institution ran into. What were the key pieces of evidence that proved it was a fraud?
Well, the first conclusive piece of evidence was the metal composition itself. They analyzed the plate to determine the exact alloy. It was made from a true brass alloy, a combination of copper and zinc.
And that's significant.
Because that specific mixture was typical of mid-19th century industrial refinement. Ancient metallurgy was very different. What they often called brass in ancient times was actually bronze, which is an alloy of copper and tin.
Okay.
And furthermore, ancient metalworking processes were, well, they were crude. The metal would have been full of impurities and inconsistent ratios. The Kinderhook plate, by contrast, was too clean, too precise. It was clearly the product of an industrial process only available in the 19th century.
So the metallurgy alone basically provided a timestamp. It proved it couldn't have been buried for centuries.
Exactly. It was chemically impossible. The second piece of evidence came from the inscription method,
which Fugate had described as acid etching.
And the science confirmed it. When you look at it under a microscope, ancient records are engraved. They're cut deeply into the surface with a tool. You see V-shaped cuts, inconsistent line widths.
But the Kinderhook plate characters were different?
They were shallow, smooth, and uniform. They were chemically etched with acid, which eats away the surrounding metal. It precisely matched Fugate's description of how they made it.
So the evidence was objective, conclusive, and absolutely devastating. The church, having used this thing as proof for 140 years, was now confronted with facts it simply could not deny.
Which leads directly to the August 1981 Ensign article. This is the institutional attempt to manage the crisis.
They can't admit that Joseph Smith or Apostle Mark E. Peterson, just 2 years earlier, was completely wrong. They have to protect the prophetic image at all costs.
So they deploy the first major narrative shift. And it requires a pretty substantial amount of historical revisionism.
The article's phrasing is so carefully chosen. It says the analysis appears to solve a previously unanswered question in church history.
A previously unanswered question.
It's institutional gaslighting, isn't it? It suggests the church was just you know, investigating whether this was a 19th century attempt to lure Joseph Smith.
Right. But there was no unanswered question in official church history. The question had been answered, publicly and definitively, for 140 years by apostles and historians. Yes, they are real, and Joseph translated them.
So this framing tries to co-opt the discovery. It makes it seem like the church was just concluding its own investigation, rather than being forced by outside proof to reverse course.
It was an attempt to get out ahead of the story, to control the narrative before critics could use the scientific findings.
Then comes the second, and arguably more audacious, defense. This is where the ensign directly contradicts William Clayton and pretty much every institutional statement made before.
It pivots to protect Joseph Smith's image. The article claims, Joseph Smith did not make the hoped-for translation. In fact, no evidence exists that he manifested any further interest in the plates after early examination.
Wait, just stop and think about the absurdity of that claim. You have John Taylor, a future prophet, publishing facsimiles and promising a full translation.
You have William Clayton, the prophet's most trusted scribe, recording a partial translation.
You have B.H. Roberts converting that record into a first-person declaration from Joseph himself. And now, in 1981, the institution's official position is that Joseph Smith was skeptical and just lost interest.
That's the historical whiplash. The institutional position flipped overnight from celebrating the plates as proof to claiming Joseph was so astute he recognized the hoax and just ignored them, despite all the historical evidence to the contrary.
This highlights a profound failure of institutional integrity. They aren't admitting error. They're strategically rewriting the historical record to insulate the founder from any accountability.
And that strategic revision becomes even more problematic when you start to look at the internal logical conflicts it creates within the church's own apologetics.
Let's pivot to that now. Let's dig into the deeper logical conflicts, because this is where the consequences really ripple out. First, you have this basic conflict of honesty and institutional integrity.
The church sets a very clear standard for its members who are seeking repentance. You have to acknowledge your sin, confess it, make restitution, and forsake the behavior. It requires radical honesty.
But the 1981 Ensign article, as the voice of the institution, it fails that standard spectacularly.
It does. They admit the plates were a hoax. They have to. The science is undeniable. But they utterly refuse to confess the sustained institutional error of endorsing that hoax for over a century. There's no restitution for decades of publishing false history.
Instead, they just rewrite the narrative to preserve the image of the prophet. Prophetic infallibility is prioritized over historical truth.
And that attempt to protect the prophet's image is most evident in how they immediately attack the source that started it all, William Clayton's journal.
Right. The Ensign article tries to distance Joseph Smith from the partial translation by claiming the origin of William Clayton's ideas is unknown. It suggests the scribe was just wildly speculating.
This is a devastating tactic, and it only works if you don't understand William Clayton's historical role. You have to remember, Clayton was Joseph Smith's most trusted scribe during the critical Nauvoo period. He was there, in Joseph's home, the day the plates arrived.
And he wasn't just writing personal notes. He was entrusted with the most sensitive and complex revelations of the entire Restoration.
Exactly. Clayton was the transcriber for key controversial sections of the Doctrine and Covenants, like sections 124, 125, and especially D&C 132, the foundational, highly secretive revelation on plural marriage.
If you believe D&C 132 is an accurate, divinely dictated text, it's because you believe William Clayton accurately recorded it.
He was so trusted, he actually officiated Joseph Smith's polygamous marriage to the 17-year-old Lucy Walker. He was an insider's insider.
So to then turn around 140 years later and claim you don't know where Clayton got the idea that Joseph translated a portion of the plates to suggest his official journal was just guesswork.
It's an institutional contradiction of the highest order. The minute the church questions Clayton's accuracy on this one inconvenient point, they necessarily undermine the divine authenticity and reliability of all the records he produced.
Including the canonized revelations the church still relies on for its core doctrines.
They need him to be a perfectly reliable scribe when he's recording the revelation on eternal marriage, but a wildly speculative and unreliable gossip when he's recording the translation of a different set of plates. It's an impossible, logically inconsistent position.
Okay, let's move to the second major consequence. This is arguably the most damaging for modern apologetics. The Kinderhook plates history essentially kills the key apologetic defenses for the Book of Abraham.
This is the critical connection. This is what makes the Kinderhook saga so important today. modern apologists trying to defend the Book of Abraham against modern Egyptology have had to create these very complex theories to explain away Joseph Smith's associated documents.
You're talking about his grammar and alphabet of the Egyptian language, the Gael.
Exactly. The Gael is this collection of Egyptian characters from the papyri, matched with Joseph's purported long, detailed, and utterly wrong translations.
Where a single, simple Egyptian symbol gets translated as an entire paragraph of theology.
A paragraph detailing the history of the priesthood, the creation of the world, whatever. Egyptologists today confirm these translations are pure imagination. They have no relationship to the actual Egyptian language.
And what's the apologetic theory used to shield Joseph Smith from being the author of this? Gibberish?
Figures like Hugh Nibley and John Gee have argued that the Gael was reverse engineered. The theory is that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Abraham by purely divine means, maybe with his seer stone, maybe using the papyrus as a catalyst. Then, after the translation was complete, his scribes went back and tried to match random characters from the papyri to the long, elaborate concepts Joseph had revealed.
So in that theory, the scribes are responsible for the demonstrably wrong translations in the Gael, not the prophet. It deflects all the blame.
Exactly. It shields him. But that defense completely implodes when you link it back to the Kinderhook plates. Apologists like Fair Mormon now argue that Joseph Smith made the partial Kinderhook translation not by divine revelation, but by comparing the Kinderhook plate symbols to the characters already cataloged in his Gael.
But why would he use the Gael if it was just reverse-engineered guesswork by his scribes?
That's the logical trap. When you look at the specific language of the partial Kinderhook translation that Clayton recorded, the part about Ham and Pharaoh, it aligns almost perfectly with the detailed, erroneous translation given to a specific symbol in the Gael.
So if Joseph Smith is comparing the Kinderhook plates to the Gael symbols to generate a translation,
he must believe the Gael is an authoritative, legitimate tool for translation. If he referenced the Gael, he inherently approved and authored the Gael. It proves the Gael was not reverse-engineered by the scribes after the fact.
That is the dead-on-arrival moment for the Book of Abraham apologetics. They're forced into an impossible choice.
Two options. Both are catastrophic. Option one, Joseph Smith relied on a demonstrably flawed text, the Gael, to translate the Kinderhook plates, which proves he authored the flawed text and lacked real translation power.
Or
option two, Joseph Smith made a divine partial translation of a fraud, proving his prophetic discernment failed spectacularly. Either way, the prophetic claim is undermined and the main defense for the Book of Abraham is rendered logically incoherent.
And that brings us to the ultimate issue here, the complete systemic failure of prophetic discernment, not just in Joseph Smith, but across the entire institutional defense.
This is the core theological problem. Joseph Smith's prophetic powers consistently failed precisely when he was not in control of the circumstances. When he controlled the process, revelations flowed. But when he was challenged by an outside objective reality,
like the lost 116 pages,
or the Book of Abraham papyri, whose meaning was known to outsiders, and now the Kinderhook plates, a physical trap set by hoaxers, the translation and discernment powers just vanished.
If he were a genuine seer, he would have looked at those plates and immediately said, "These are 19th century fakes etched with acid. You're being deceived."
But he didn't. He gave a partial incorrect translation and then tried to kick the can down the road. Fugate recalled that Joseph eventually suggested the plates be sent to three different antiquarian societies in Philadelphia, France, and England.
That's a classic deflection maneuver. Buy time, offload accountability to secular authorities. It's not the act of a seer with divine insight.
It's the move of a leader trying to maintain control and avoid exposure.
And the philosophical conflict here is huge. You have revelations like DNC 132, where Joseph Smith claims God sent an angel with a drawn sword to force him into polygamy.
It raises a serious question about divine priorities. If God can intervene with an armed angel to ensure Joseph complies with a difficult, controversial commandment, why couldn't God send a simple revelation, a whisper, an impression, to stop the prophet from publicly endorsing a fraudulent set of plates that would be proven fake 140 years later?
Why not save the church from decades of historical error and embarrassment?
The pattern suggests a correlation. God's revelations align perfectly with Joseph Smith's goals when he is in control. When he's challenged by objective reality, the revelation, the discernment, and the translation power all vanish. And that failure didn't stop with him. It extended to B.H. Roberts, to the head of the BYU Archaeological Society, and all the way to Apostle Mark E. Peterson.
So let's finalize the credibility scorecard for Joseph Smith as a translator. He claimed this divine gift, but his record shows zero successful translations that can stand up to objective scrutiny.
You have the Book of Mormon with unverifiable sources, the Book of Moses with unoriginal content, the Book of Abraham, a demonstrable mistranslation, the JST Bible, which is theological revisionism, and now, definitively, the Kinderhook plates.
This isn't a failure in one isolated case. It's a systemic failure of the calling itself. The Kinderhook plates are a critical piece of corroborating evidence because they tie all these threads together.
They validate the fraudulent nature of his folk magic background. The treasure-digging lore was used by the hoaxers to set the trap, and it confirms the incorrect nature of the Book of Abraham translation by undermining the key apologetic defenses for the Gale.
In short, this event reinforces a definitive pattern. Whenever Joseph Smith's prophetic claims could be objectively tested, they failed.
And the institutional response, the 1981 reversal, reinforces the secondary pattern. When a prophet fails, the institution rewrites the history rather than admitting the sustained error.
Here's the final provocative thought for you to take with you, something to explore on your own that builds on all this. The entire foundation of prophetic authority rests on the premise of discernment. The ability to know truth from error, the divine guidance that supposedly prevents institutional mistakes.
So if generations of prophets, seers, and revelators, from Joseph Smith in 1843, through the historians in the 1960s, all the way to Apostle Mark E. Peterson in 1979, if they could not discern a 19th-century acid-etched hoax from an ancient secret record.
What does this massive systematic failure tell you about their claims and ability to provide reliable guidance on spiritual matters that cannot be scientifically tested? If they fail the objective tests, what confidence should we place in the subjective ones?
That is the question at the heart of the Kinderhook Plates controversy.
That's a deep question to ponder. We hope this deep dive has given you the tools to understand this critical moment in history. We'll see you next time.